Thank you. Be seated. Our court is ready to hear arguments for petitioners in Busnara versus Ford Motor Company.
May it please the court, Mr. Andy Kerr will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. First of all, I want to thank this court for taking this case along with the McDavid-Subaru case to address the important issues about the scope of the Texas Motor Vehicle Board's jurisdiction, and particularly in our case, the rights of prospective dealers to bring an action when their rights have also been violated. This is a case about the rights of those who contract to purchase automobile dealerships in Texas. Their right to complain when an automobile manufacturer acts without justification to prevent them from obtaining a dealership, and their right to a forum in which to bring their complaint. Hanan and Gil Butneru are father and son who contracted to buy the Ford Lincoln Mercury dealership in Del Rio. Their application to be approved by Ford as an authorized dealer was short-circuited when Ford decided to exercise a right of first refusal that Ford had inserted into its franchise agreement with its dealer, Martin Graff. The right of first refusal itself is a violation of Section 502B8 of the code, which prevents a manufacturer from preventing or failing to give effect to a transfer of an automobile dealership. Under the code, under Section 104 of the code, it is void and unenforceable because it is in effect a waiver of provisions of that section of Section 502B8. It is also inconsistent with the provision, with that provision of the code, which makes it unenforceable under Section 4.03E of the code. In fact, the Motor Vehicle Board itself has held that a right of first refusal can't be used to bypass state law to prevent a transfer of an automobile dealership. That was in the Star Motor Cars versus Mercedes-Benz case that is cited in the brief in, I believe, footnote 4 or 6. The Butnerus, following the exercise or notice of the exercise, to file right.
Excuse me, Mr. Allen.
Yes.
Are you saying that the board's ruling is that a right of first refusal is void as against public policy, or depending on how it's exercised, it's not permitted?
I believe the board found in that case, Your Honor, that as the right of first refusal was exercised in the Star Motors case, that it was unenforceable under the provisions of the code and would not be permitted.
But just the fact that there is a right of first refusal in the franchise agreement itself is not void.
Well, I don't know that the board held that, Your Honor. There is authority for that proposition, not in Texas, but in the Bayview in Florida. There was a decision out of the court there. It's the Bayview versus General Motors case. And in that case, the Florida court held that a right of first refusal on its face was a violation of public policy as against the standards that had been set in that statute with respect to the transfer of dealerships.
Florida statute similar to this?
It is similar to our statute, Your Honor. It's not as detailed as our statute in terms of the process by which a prospective transferee must meet in order to become a dealer. But it does set up a process whereby transfers of dealerships are regulated. And in that regard, the site on that case is Bayview Buick versus General Motors. It's at 597 Southern 2nd, 887. It was a 1992 case out of the First District Court of Appeal in Florida. In this case, the Butneru's filed suit to prevent the transfer of the dealership to Ford, claiming tortious interference with their contracts to buy the dealership and seeking a declaratory judgment as to their rights under their contracts and the effect of the right of first refusal on their rights. The district court determined that the transfer should be enjoined. It found that Ford may have violated both sections 501B of the code and 502B8 of the code by attempting to prevent the transfer to the Baton Rouge without following the process for approving prospective dealers as set forth in Section 501B of the Code. On appeal, the Court of Appeals threw out the Baton Rouge case against Ford. They did that based on its view that the Code gave the Board exclusive jurisdiction over all disputes involving the distribution and sale of motor vehicles, thereby ousting the District Court of subject matter jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals also found that the Baton Rouge had no standing to complain of Ford's conduct because, as prospective dealers, they were afforded no rights or remedies under the Code. The Court of Appeals decision leaves the Baton Rouge and all prospective dealers in Texas without any forum to complain about the unlawful conduct of a manufacturer that prevents them from acquiring an automobile dealership in Texas. What the Baton Rouge want is for the Code to be enforced and to be free from conduct that violates the Code and interferes with their contractual right to purchase this dealership.
And you believe that, that you can win solely on statutory interpretation without resorting to a constitutional challenge?
Well, Your Honor, what has arisen is, yes, we believe that the Board does not have exclusive jurisdiction, and therefore the District Court is not ousted of its jurisdiction, and therefore the constitutionality of the Code would not be called into play. However, as the McDavid Court in the Dallas Court of Appeals decided, if its interpretation of the Code is adopted.
But you believe the McDavid interpretation is not correct. I mean, that's only your alternative.
That is correct. We believe that there is no provision that gives the Board exclusive jurisdiction to adjudicate the claims that the Baton Rouge have asserted here, or really over any claim involving the sale and distribution of motor vehicles, except in very limited circumstances, which are contained in Section 5.014 of the Code. And there the legislature expressed and explicitly stated there that the Board has exclusive jurisdiction to determine whether signage complies with the Code. But if you look throughout the rest of the Code, there is no other mention of exclusive jurisdiction. If you look at Section 3.01A of the Code, it gives the Board general and original jurisdiction to regulate all aspects of the distribution, sale, and leasing of motor vehicles. But it is not given exclusive jurisdiction either to regulate or adjudicate. Courts are not ousted from jurisdiction unless the legislature explicitly grants exclusive jurisdiction to the administrative body. That's the holding in Gregg versus Delhi. Here, the legislature did not grant exclusive jurisdiction to the Board. Now, Section 301B of the Code states that all aspects of the distribution and sale of motor vehicles shall be governed exclusively by the provisions of the Code, but it does not say that the Board has exclusive jurisdiction to adjudicate disputes that involve the Code. It says that if you want to know what you have to do, for instance, to transfer a dealership, then you look to the Code, in the Code alone, and that governs all aspects of the transfer of the dealership. But it does not give the Board exclusive jurisdiction to determine all disputes arising out of that. As further evidence of the legislature's intent not to grant exclusive jurisdiction in this area, it does not require exhaustion of administrative remedies. There is only one section of the Code that requires the exhaustion of administrative remedies. That's in Section 6.07, dealing with warranty performance obligations. This Court observed in the Cash America case that when the legislature vests exclusive jurisdiction in an agency, exhaustion of administrative remedies is required because there is no such requirement in the Code related to actions arising out of violations of Section 502. The legislature must not have and did not intend the Board to have exclusive jurisdiction. Now, both the San Antonio Court in this case and the Dallas Court of Appeals in the McDavid case determined that the Code gave the Board exclusive jurisdiction. Now, we disagree with that conclusion, but we do agree with the Dallas Court that if the Code, in fact, gives the Board exclusive jurisdiction, the Code violates the open courts provision of the Texas Constitution. Legislation violates the open courts provision and is a denial of due process if its effect is to abrogate common law rights to assert common law causes of action without substituting other reasonable remedies. And that is exactly the way the San Antonio Court of Appeals has interpreted the code in this case. First, in the court's view, the district court has no jurisdiction to adjudicate tortious interference claims.
What about the prior case where they said other reasonable remedies would be the DTPA claim and the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing? Why would that not be reasonable?
You're talking about in the McDavid case? Well, Your Honor, I can't really, I'm going to think about that for a minute. I really haven't focused on the DTPA and other claims that were asserted in that case. But if those remedies are provided, I don't know that they really stem from being provided by the code so much as they existed independent of the code, and the code simply adopted them as remedies that could also be pursued in good faith and fair dealing cases.
Are there other remedies, though, within the Act that arguably would protect you or be a substitute for your common law claim?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe, with regard to rising out of violations of Section 502b8, that there are any other remedies provided in the code other than in the sense that the code extends protection to prospective dealers as well as dealers themselves. What the code does provide in Section 501b is a means by which a protest can be filed if a prospective dealer's if a prospective dealer is disapproved. In other words, if his qualifications or his business experience don't measure up to approval by the manufacturer. In that event, then what we're talking about is not unlawful conduct as prescribed by Section 502b8, but we're talking about a disapproval of a prospective dealer based on his qualifications and business experience. In that event, the code provides a process by which a dealer may protest the rejection of the prospective transferee, and the board can then determine the qualifications of the prospective transferee. So that is not exactly our case, but if it got that far, and that's of course what the Boutineries are asking, is that it allowed to be get that far in the process so that their qualifications can be fairly determined. And then, of course, we wouldn't be here unless we believe the Boutineries qualified for this, and that they, upon a fair determination of their qualifications, they would become the dealers in Del Rio.
Mr. Curry, let's talk about jurisdiction a little bit. This is an appeal from a temporary injunction or the dismissal of a temporary injunction, but there's other matters still pending in the trial court.
That's correct.
And so our jurisdiction, what is our jurisdiction based on in this case?
Well, there are two bases for the jurisdiction in this case, Your Honor. First of all, you look to Section 22.225 of the Texas Government Code, and it provides that the court has jurisdiction over if there's a conflict in decisions among the Court of Appeals or a dissent in the Court of Appeals in this case, which there was not. But the other basis of the jurisdiction...
Is there a conflict?
Yes, there are two conflicts, okay. Your Honor. The first conflict is between the McDavid case in this case with regard to whether the board has exclusive jurisdiction, and if the board has exclusive jurisdiction, what the consequences of that are, whether it's unconstitutional or constitutional.
Both cases decided there was exclusive jurisdiction.
Both cases decided that there was exclusive jurisdiction, both the Boutineries Court of Appeals and the McDavid Court.
So there wasn't a conflict there.
Well, the conflict came in the results of that conclusion that there was exclusive jurisdiction. The McDavid Court said exclusive jurisdiction, common law claims are abrogated, therefore the grant of exclusive jurisdiction is unconstitutional. The Court of Appeals in San Antonio said exclusive jurisdiction, these common law claims may be abrogated, but that's not unconstitutional. And so that's the conflict between those two cases.
You just started to say there was another basis.
Yes, the other basis, this court in the Houston Federation case decided in 1987 stated that in an appeal of a temporary injunction that was decided on jurisdictional grounds, the Supreme Court had jurisdiction notwithstanding the limitations on its jurisdiction under 22.225. And so that is another basis for the court's exercise of jurisdiction.
What was that holding again in that case?
It said That was a temporary appeal in a temporary injunction case. The court stated, noted, that normally its jurisdiction would be limited by Section 22.225, but when the case has been decided on jurisdictional grounds, the Supreme Court has jurisdiction to hear that. And because that's the case here, then we are before the court.
What about the Court of Appeals jurisdiction to hear more than a temporary injunction on an interlocutory appeal?
Well, obviously, Your Honor, well, about whether the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction to decide whether the trial court had jurisdiction.
If I understand, the only order that you took up is the temporary injunction.
That's correct.
That's the only one that was issued. Everything else is still there, isn't that right?
That is correct. That is correct.
Can the court decide the merits of claims when you only have a total merits and issue some order on appeal?
Well,
when you're on that kind of an interlocutory appeal?
You mean can the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals?
No, the Court of Appeals.
No, the Court of Appeals can't decide the merits of the case. It should only be able to look to whether the trial court abused its discretion in granting the temporary injunction.
Any other questions? The court is ready to hear arguments from response.
May it please the court, Mr. David Ivey will present argument for the respondents.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Ivey. Here representing Ford Motor Company, in this case arising out of a decision in the district court in Valverde County, Texas. My argument is brief, and I'd be glad to answer any questions. The statutes at issue, the Texas Motor Vehicle Code, in particular section 3.01 and 3.01b, confer original exclusive jurisdiction on the Texas Motor Vehicle Board to determine solely the provisions within the statute.
To determine violations of the code.
That's correct, sir.
Is that as far as you think that exclusive jurisdiction goes?
Absolutely.
So that we really are going to look at primary jurisdiction on the issue that's before us?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe that. The reason that the issue before this court is whether the petitioner's claims were based upon the provisions of the Act. The board has to look to the Act to make the determination as to whether a prospective dealer has any rights under this Act. Nowhere in the Act does the term prospective dealer appear.
Well, what is your definition of exclusive jurisdiction?
Definition of exclusive jurisdiction is the definition this court used in Cash America, which is where the legislature has given to a body the exclusive right to determine an issue, obviously subject to, in the case of an administrative law body, the administrative appeals process.
Whereas, I thought that was primary jurisdiction.
Primary jurisdiction is concurrent jurisdiction, where an action may be brought in the state in a court of general jurisdiction. That court then considers the arguments of the parties as to whether the action ought to stay in the district court or be referred to the administrative body.
Regardless of what we call it or not, is it your position that the legislature intended with this statute to replace the plaintiff's common law remedies with the remedies provided in the Act?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so it's not an exclusive jurisdiction case, then it's a primary jurisdiction case.
I still believe it's an exclusive jurisdiction case.
We just disagree on what exclusive jurisdiction is.
Okay. I believe your court said that we conclude the trial court does not have jurisdiction over the Bucnari's claims to the extent their claims are based on violations of the Act. That's consistent with B, 301B, isn't it?
The exclusive.
But that doesn't say that the rest of their claims that are not based on violations, if any, are within the jurisdiction of the board.
That's absolutely correct.
So we then look to primary jurisdiction to see the basis for the common law claims.
I don't believe we need to look to primary jurisdiction. I believe in the Boutnery case that the Boutnery's properly invoked the jurisdiction of the Del Rio District Court, a court of general jurisdiction. The issue was then raised as to whether there was the ability of that court to adjudicate claims based on these provisions of the code. And while in the brief of the petitioners, they make the claim that they're not making claims under the code, in Appendix F to the brief, page 8, section 4, causes of action, the very first sentence, Ford's attempted exercise of the right of first refusal is in violation of the code.
Okay, but you just said that they properly invoked the jurisdiction of the district court.
That's correct.
How did they do that?
The court is a court of general jurisdiction, and their claims are stated as common law claims. They're simply based upon interpretations of the statute.
Does that include the breach of contract claim?
That's correct. They allege in their causes of action that each cause of action is based on a violation of the code. The proper thing is the remedy set out by the Court of Appeals for those claims to be sent to the board for determination. And that's what happened. The Boutonnieres filed a protest with the board. The board held an evidentiary hearing as to whether or not they had jurisdiction.
So then after the board gets done determining if there's a violation, what would you abate? The district court proceeding should be abated in the interim?
In the interim, yes.
And then you could go back, they could go back and try their damage claims in the district court after the board was completed.
Absolutely.
Do you think the board has the statutory authority to hear this claim?
I don't believe the board has the statutory authority to hear the claims asserted by the Boutonnieres in the original petition, because they are based upon the Motor Vehicle Act, and the Motor Vehicle Act does not provide any relief for a prospective dealer, other than if the board believed that there was a violation of the act in some form or fashion, it could initiate its own proceeding to investigate that in its enforcement section. It can't grant the Boutonnieres relief, but it could find a violation of the enforcement section, under the enforcement section, which would then possibly give the petitioners a basis to go forward in the state court action supported by findings by the board.
You're talking about now specifically the right of first refusal. The board can decide whether that violates the code or not.
Yes, Justice Olin, and in my opinion, the board could have taken up on its own the question of whether the right of first refusal was improper under the code, and it would have done that by referring it to the enforcement section.
Did the prospective sellers have a cause of action because of the right of first refusal that the board could have heard?
Yes.
Had they chosen to exercise that? Apparently they reached a deal with the board.
The right of first refusal arose in an amendment to the dealership agreement well prior to the Boutonnieres' request to purchase the dealership.
But, I mean, they would have had, I suppose, authority to go to the board and say this part of our contract with Ford was illegal or violates some section.
No question.
And they chose not to do that.
Now, I thought your position, too, was that as prospective purchasers or prospective dealers, that the Boutonnieres had no standing to complain to the board about a violation of the code.
That's correct.
So how are they supposed to get a determination from the court from the board that there was a violation of the code if you say they can't be heard there? I'm not quite sure how this going back and forth works under those circumstances.
Well, the board found they had no standing to complain. In the leapfrog fashion, they attempted to complain, which was to leapfrog Graf Ford, the ownership of the owner of the dealership, and put themselves in that position and say what should have happened is the normal process, that Ford should have reviewed the application for dealership, made a determination. Based on that determination, we could protest that finding or were granted the right to take the dealership. The board looked at that and said, no, you don't have standing to do that. You're a prospective dealer. This code was enacted to protect dealers.
Well, if that's the case, then I don't understand how the board could have jurisdiction of any kind over the claims that the Bootneroos are making in the district court. If you say they don't have standing to be heard in the board, then why doesn't jurisdiction to resolve all of this lie in the district court?
Because they do have standing to ask the board for an enforcement action, and the board can bring an enforcement action on its own. And that enforcement action doesn't grant the remedies that the Bootneroos may be entitled to at common law, but in accordance with the code, the Bootneroos, if they prevailed under a complaint process, could then take that to the district court and say, we have findings by an administrative body that this action was improper, and we ask that you look to those with deference and only set them aside for an abuse of discretion.
All right. Now, what provisions of the code are you relying upon with respect to the fact that they should have gone to the board for enforcement proceedings? And I take it what would be litigated there would be their alleged violation of the code. Is that right?
That's correct.
And what provision of the statute do we look to for that?
3.05A. Whenever the board has reason to believe through receipt of a complaint or otherwise that a violation of this act or a board rule, order, or decision has occurred or is likely to occur, the board shall conduct an investigation unless it determines that a complaint is frivolous or for the purpose of harassment.
Regardless of how you define exclusive or not, if I understand your argument, you're leaning to a result that is an abatement of the plaintiff's case, awaiting the administrative agency to make its ruling, and then come back to the trial court to litigate the remaining claims not otherwise disposed of by the board's decision.
Yes, yes,
and
sir.
Giving due deference to the fact findings that the board makes that relate to the remaining causes of action.
Yes, yes, sir.
What is it you want the board to do in this case?
The board has done what we want them to do in this case, Justice Olin. There was an administrative law proceeding. The administrative law judge issued her proposal for decision. The board considered that, and the board ruled that the Bootneroos lack standing to bring a protest because the code, the act, doesn't provide any relief for prospective dealers.
So now we're procedurally, where are we?
Well, I guess procedurally, I'm not sure of the timetable. Perhaps the Bootneroos could appeal that through the Administrative Procedure Act and bring that up then to the court for consideration as to whether that was a proper decision or not. Or they can accept that finding and go back to Del Rio, rephrase their causes of action, which is what the Court of Appeals told them to do, and bring tortious interference, breach of contract, and declaratory judgment. They just can't do it based upon the act or the code under the current law.
So does that then mean, because of that ruling, that clearly the Bootneroos at least have the opportunity to plead and try to prove common law causes of action and get the remedies that those claims would provide in the state district court?
Absolutely.
So it's your... I don't understand how I'm sorry to go back to the enforcement proceedings again, but if they went through the administrative proceeding and there was a determination they had no standing to protest, in other words, you can't complain about a violation of the act, I take it that means, what good would an enforcement proceeding do then? What does the enforcement proceeding have to do about this? Because could they really actually complain in an enforcement proceeding as well if they don't have standing to complain that the act is violated?
Well, they don't have standing to bring a protest because they're not covered by that portion of the act. They're not, prospective dealers are not covered. This gets back to this.
Well, I know, but if they're not covered by that piece of the act, if that really is the case, then what's going to happen in an enforcement proceeding? They're not a person who can say to the board, you should do something about this situation, is it?
Well,
I'm just missing the...
Anyone can come forward, any citizen of the state can come forward to the board and request that enforcement action be brought. And again, I'm not up on the timetable as to whether that period has run for the Boutin-Rouges. I also have not briefed the issue of the conclusiveness of the finding by the board of lack of standing to bring a protest as opposed to a complaint.
But can they file a complaint alleging a violation of Section 502B8?
They could have, at least initially. I'm not sure at this procedural stage that they can do that, but they could have come in.
I thought they didn't have standing to complain about a violation of that particular section of the code.
They do have standing to complain about that. Any citizen has standing to bring a complaint. Only those protected by the other provisions of the Motor Vehicle Act.
Any citizen can bring a request for enforcement.
That's correct.
But the remedies are penalties, cease and desist, or injunction.
That's correct.
If they penalize Ford in a dollar amount, who gets the money?
The state.
So, effectively, that doesn't really compensate the Boutin-Rouges.
That's correct.
Cease and desist, what can the Boutin-Rouges get through a cease and desist order issued by the board?
Well, perhaps a cease and desist order could prevent Ford from exercising its right of first refusal retroactively. The main thing that I believe could have happened if a protest action had been brought, a complaint had been brought for enforcement, is that the findings then by the board, if the board took the complaint, could then be taken over to Del Rio. And if one of the findings was this right of first refusal is what the petitioners say it is, an attempt to circumvent the act, then they can go before the district court judge and say, we now have a finding by the board that's final that this right of first refusal was invalid under the code, and use that as a basis for their claim.
But that, what that results in, that analysis means that the Boutin-Rouges have circumvented the act by going through the enforcement procedure to get a finding that the board wouldn't make under any other section because the board holds they don't have standing under the act. That's circuitous.
They don't have standing to bring a protest to complain about these procedures.
But they can still get the same. Well, the premise you made is that the Boutin-Rouges are prospective dealers. The act doesn't cover them at all.
No.
Right? But as a citizen, they can come in and say, enforce the act for us. But the result is they get the same end result as if they got it under the other part. That just doesn't make sense.
The distinction is if they had pursued a protest action and had standing to pursue a protest action, the board then would have had the power.
Oh, I understand that.
But
the board said you can't do that.
That's correct. But under the enforcement action, the board cannot say that you violated this particular portion of the act with respect to approval of a dealership or not. It could have simply said whether this right of first refusal was valid or not. So I believe there's a distinction in that it's not one side of the coin versus the other.
It seems to me your position is stronger if indeed the board routinely listens to citizen complaints and issues cease and desist orders or other orders that don't result in a monetary transfer from one party to the other, so that the board failing to take action here could in effect be regarded as a determination by the board of this matter. But if I'm on target, shouldn't we take judicial notice of how many complaints are filed by citizens, by non-dealers to the board, and how often they act on them, or do you think that is an impermissible way?
I would think that would be permissible.
That would also pull in complaints about advertising, lemon law, all those kinds of things too, right? Consumer complaints would come in underneath that too, wouldn't it?
No, Madam Justice, I don't believe it would, because those are areas that are specifically addressed as available to citizens as opposed to dealers and manufacturers. I believe Justice Phillips' question is the pointed question of how many consumer complaints on issues similar to what the Boutonnieroos are bringing, where they're saying we're not specifically covered by the Act, such as coverage under the Lemon Law, but we think something went wrong, and we want the board to consider.
Right, but I understand. But aren't the investigation and enforcement proceedings that the board typically sees, aren't they related to more consumer type of complaints with respect to dealing with either dealers or manufacturers?
Oh, I think that they are, and
like I said, Lemon Law complaints and advertising complaints and various other kinds of things like that the Act covers as well?
I think that's absolutely correct, and I think that that's very consistent with the board's decision here, where it could have on its own, based on the protest that the Boutonnieroos filed, said we don't believe a protest is proper, but we're going to make a referral over to the enforcement section and allow the enforcement section to make a decision.
I just want to make sure I'm clear what your vision is of what happens from here. That's what I'm kind of lost here, what you want to happen. You go back to the trial court, and the Boutonnieroos still say, we still think that the right of first refusal violates the code, and we don't have a definitive determination from the board on that. Who gets to decide that issue?
Well, I think at this point we do have a definitive answer from the board on that issue. Now, that issue then could be preserved for appeal, obviously, and the courts of appeal could then revisit the issue of whether a prospective dealer could make a complaint under provisions of the Act. But I believe at this point, procedurally where we stand, is we should go back to Del Rio and try our lawsuit under the recognized common law causes of action, if they're able to prove them and they prevail.
But you're saying the Boutonnieroos cannot argue in the trial court that the right of first refusal violates the Act?
At this point, that's what I believe, yes.
Even though you acknowledge they could bring an enforcement proceeding and we could get a determination from the board one way or the other?
I'm not certain that they could. I believe originally they could have. I just am not certain.
If the board refuses to address it, when can the court step in and decide does the right of first refusal violate the code or not?
Well, if the board had simply refused to opine on the question of whether the Boutonnieroos had standing or not, it would have left no alternative but for the trial court, a court of general jurisdiction, to make that determination. But the board, in this case, accepted the case, heard the evidence, and issued its finding that there was no violation, that there was no standing on the part of the Boutonnieroos to sue under the code, to base their common law causes of action under the code.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Andy Kerr will present the rebuttal for the petitioners.
If I may paraphrase a sentence out of the Cash America opinion, the Act in this case must be read to constrain manufacturers, not to restrict the remedies of prospective dealers. What we have here is a question not only of primary jurisdiction, which I'd like to address briefly, but also a question of what rights are afforded prospective dealers under the Act. First of all, the primary jurisdiction doctrine is the principle that determines whether the court or agency should make the initial decision in a case. We believe that both the board and the district court in these situations generally have concurrent jurisdiction, but whether primary jurisdiction would divest the district court of jurisdiction or not is subject to several standards. First of all, where the issue is one inherently judicial in nature, the court retains its jurisdiction, and that was set forth in the Gregg versus Delhi Taylor case. Also, if the agency is powerless to grant the relief, the court retains its jurisdiction. Now, if the agency has authority to make incidental findings, then the matter can be abated and the action deferred to the agency. After the agency has made its findings, returned to the district court. But what we have here is that we have two things. Number one, the Boutonnieroos have brought a tortious interference with their contracts claim. And that claim is dependent upon facts that to be found by the court or by the jury and determined by the court as to whether there's been a tortious interference through the actions of Ford. Ford's defense to that claim is that its actions were justified. It had a right of first refusal. Well, even if the complaint didn't implicate the code, the court would have jurisdiction to hear a challenge to the exercise of a right of first refusal. That's the Abraham Investments versus Payne Ranch case decided by the Amarillo Court of Appeals.
That'd be justification as a matter of law. If there's a first right of first refusal, that's justification as a matter of law.
Well, even the Amarillo Court of Appeals, the Abraham case, said, Your Honor, that that right has to be exercised properly. And if it's not exercised properly, it can be challenged by the purchaser under a contract. And they have standing to challenge that right. And so, in terms of the jurisdiction of the court, then...
That would simply be under the contract principles on the exercise of the right of first refusal, but that wouldn't be a tortious, that wouldn't be a tort of tortious interference.
No. Well, it could be. I mean, a right of first refusal is an interference in the contract. And the question becomes, under...
Justification.
It becomes justification, which is an affirmative defense, which is something that the defense has to establish, not the plaintiff. And so in that instance, from the plaintiff's point of view, in establishing its case in the district court, there really is no primary jurisdiction issue there. The primary jurisdiction issue comes with respect to Ford's defense of justification, and that is whether it had an enforceable right of first refusal. And that is purely a legal question. It's whether the right of first refusal.
In this case, would it simply be a matter of telling the Court of Appeals that where it went wrong was declaring that it didn't have jurisdiction and dismissing it, and what it really should have done was abate the claims pending the board determining the validity of the right of first refusal?
Well, I agree with the first part of that, Your Honor, which is that the Court of Appeals should tell the district court that it has jurisdiction, because it does. The second part of that, we believe, is that the decision about whether to accede to the agency's determination is a matter left with the district court, that the district court makes the decision in its discretion about whether to defer to the agency's jurisdiction or whether to retain jurisdiction and continue on with the case. And so we believe that that decision should be left with the district court. That is not a decision that has been made or even addressed.
No one's asked the court.
No one's asked it. That's correct.
District court to defer.
Where we left it was the district court felt like this conduct should be enjoined and we should move on to a determination of whether the right of first refusal was enforceable and whether the process of evaluating the Bruttner's qualifications could go forward. Because what has happened is all the evaluation of their qualifications just stopped once the right of first refusal was exercised. They were not given a meaningful review of their qualifications. And so that's what we seek, is to go back to the district court, to have the right of first refusal thrown out, to enjoin the transfer of the dealership to Ford Motor Company and its assign, and to get this whole process back on track under Section 501.
But your claim of throwing out the right of first refusal is based on being a violation of the code, which is something that the board would have an interest in determining.
I think that
so
it would.
The board could determine that it didn't have jurisdiction because it's not a dealer, or the board could determine it did have jurisdiction because it was a prospective dealer and decide the merits. But in either way, you'd end up back in the district court after that to fight out over whether or not there was a proper right of first refusal in the contract.
I believe that's correct.
What would you do if someone made it? You go back to the district court, you try to proceed in the trial court, and Ford says, wait a minute, now let's ask for primary jurisdiction deferral and let the commission or board decide whether the right of first refusal violates the code. Then where are you procedurally in front of the board? What would you do then?
Well, where we are procedurally in front of the board, Your Honor, is kind of where we are right now. The Bruttner's filed a complaint with the board.
You filed a protest.
Pardon, no, not a protest, and that's an important distinction to make. A protest is filed under Section 501B to complain about whether the qualifications were properly considered in approving or disapproving a dealer.
So you filed a complaint?
We filed a complaint saying because the Ford and its assign were trying to get this thing transferred through the board, and when we found out about it, we said, we've got to go to the board and stop the issuance of a new license to the new dealer. And
how would
take
you get this? Let me short circuit this. Okay. How would you now get the issue of the validity of the right of first refusal resolved before the board? What procedural vehicle is open to you to do that?
Well, the board has conceded basically that there's this right of enforcement or enforcement action that we could bring.
Why haven't you brought that?
Well, because we've been bringing this complaint, which, in our opinion, frankly, Your Honor, we think the board should consider it, whether it's styled a complaint or an enforcement action or whatever. But if the board requires an enforcement action, then we'll file an enforcement action if we are relegated to the board to have that issue decided. And that would be procedurally how we would proceed. But we would need, frankly, we need some direction and some affirmance of the board's jurisdiction to hear our complaint or our enforcement action so that we don't run up against this wall again where we're told that we don't have standing, notwithstanding the fact that Section 501B is replete. I think there are over 20 references to prospective transferees in Section 501B alone.
But does that contemplate an existing dealer as a prospective transferee as opposed to a prospective dealer in the first instance?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think that if you're a prospective transferee, it doesn't matter whether you're an existing dealer or a non-dealer, that in terms of the process and the board's view of whether you have standing or not, it's going to be dependent upon your role in that transaction as opposed to whether you're an existing dealer.
I hate to prolong this, but now I'm hearing something that I didn't get from your brief or from your initial argument, which is you think the act properly read should let you come into the board on the same terms as somebody who's already a dealer?
We think that there are two bases for jurisdiction, our standing, I guess. Number one is that we have our common law rights to allege that our contract has been tortiously interfered with and to have those elements determined by court, by the district court. Secondly, we believe affirmance of the board's jurisdiction to hear our complaint or our enforcement action so that we don't run up against this wall again where we're told that we don't have standing, notwithstanding the fact that Section 501B is replete. I think there are over 20 references to prospective transferees in Section 501B alone.
But does that contemplate an existing dealer as a prospective transferee as opposed to a prospective dealer in the first instance?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think that if you're a prospective transferee, it doesn't matter whether you're an existing dealer or a non-dealer, that in terms of the process and the board's view of whether you have standing or not, it's going to be dependent upon your role in that transaction as opposed to whether you're an existing dealer.
I hate to prolong this, but now I'm hearing something that I didn't get from your brief or from your initial argument, which is you think the act properly read should let you come into the board on the same terms as somebody who's already a dealer?
We think that there are two bases for jurisdiction, our standing, I guess. Number one is that we have our common law rights to allege that our contract has been tortiously interfered with and to have those elements determined by court, by the district court. Secondly, we believe that we do have the right to bring a direct action for violation of the code, because we believe that the code does protect.
So really there's three arguments you've got, as I understand it. And then I'll be through. But both courts below that we're dealing with have misread the code, because in fact, as a prospective dealer, you could bring a claim in the board and get board relief. Secondly, no, you don't bring a claim in the board, or you could, but you can also go to district court and get damages. Thirdly, no, you can't bring any claim in the board, and that violates the Constitution. You're giving us three choices that kind of go across the whole possible array. Am I getting it all now?
Well, I think that's right, Your Honor. I mean, it's reflective of what's happened to the Bootneroos. They've been whipsawed between the district court and the administrative board, and they want a place to bring their complaint.
But you think it's a valid reading of the statute that the board is a place to bring that complaint?
I think it is. I think that.
But I didn't hear that or see it in your brief.
Well, in the brief, we argued about the private cause of action and the fact that a private cause of action can be implied from the statute, If you follow the...
No, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about you going to the board and getting relief from the board.
Well, right. Well, and we believe that, yes. And that would be consistent with the concurrent...
And not something that they can hear if they want to, but the board would have to hear...
Right, and that's consistent, Your Honor, with concurrent jurisdiction. What we're saying is, yes, the board and the court have concurrent jurisdiction. If we decide to bring our action in district court, then it becomes a question of primary jurisdiction, about whether the board has the first shot at this or whether the court can go forward. But that is not saying that they're mutually exclusive, except under the analysis of primary jurisdiction, which you look to see whether it's a matter inherently judicial in nature, whether the board can provide you a remedy, or whether there's a remedy under the code.
Okay.
So far, we've been told that there is no remedy under the code, so that would support the district court going forward.
Have you appealed or sought review of the board's determination you don't have standing?
There's a motion for rehearing pending that will be decided either this Friday or this Monday, and we don't know the outcome of that, and depending upon the outcome, obviously, will depend upon what we do.
Any other questions?
Yes. Insofar as the district court action, all of your common law claims still pend there, is that correct?
Yes, they do, including I'll take that back. The tortious interference claim, which the Court of Appeals held was based on the act, has been dismissed.
By the trial court?
By the Court of Appeals, for lack of jurisdiction.
Nope. I thought they said... Yes, I see what they did to you.
Yes.
I do now, yes. So you would have to refile those unless
you reverse
set aside the Court of Appeals judgment in this case.
Because
his scenario that he talked about going back and forth was based on the fact that the common law claims were still there.
Well, they're not. With respect to Ford, I mean, they would love for us to go back and have our common law claims against Graf, Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, because we wouldn't have any claims left against Ford. And so what we're asking this court to do is to reverse the Court of Appeals' decision that dismissed those claims for lack of jurisdiction and hold
on the basis of, say, the Forey case, that there's the proper disposition under this kind of a conclusion is for the trial court to have abated it, to wait the outcome, what happens, but not so the Court of Appeals doesn't have the authority or the discretion to dismiss them.
Well, and I guess really beyond the Forey case, Your Honor, would be under Dubai and under the exclusive jurisdiction argument that we made earlier is that the code does not divest the district court of jurisdiction because exclusive jurisdiction is not given to the board.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the district court has jurisdiction over our claims, notwithstanding the fact that they may involve the construction of the act by virtue of Ford's defense to our tortious interference claim.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the second case. We'll take another brief recess.
All rise.